If you would please go ahead and join me in 2 Kings chapter number 6. We're going to pick up at verse 32. We don't know exactly when this attack from the Syrian army against northern Israel took place, but I suspect it's in the time of King Jehoram of northern Israel. And the king of Israel is clearly very upset that God is not doing anything to protect them from this attack. In fact, I get the impression that he even thinks God's kind of responsible for it, and that it's the fault of the prophet Elisha, who is somewhere nearby. Because the last thing that we read was that when the king was faced with a dilemma between two of his women living in the city, not sharing the meat of their own children on subsequent occasions, and wanting, you know, judicial relief from that situation, the king basically swears that Elisha needs to die for apparently being involved in this. Verse 32, we take up the story with that idea. Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. So he is publicly present in the besieged city of Samaria, and some of the leadership of the city are with him. Now, what are they doing? Probably praying together. Now, the king had dispatched a man from his presence, but before the messenger arrived, Elisha said to the elders, "Do you see how this murderer has sent to take off my head?" So apparently the king of northern Israel had sent someone to arrest him and chop his head off. And he knew about it because God's Holy Spirit reveals it to him. And so he reveals that to the other leaders of the city. "Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door, hold the door fast against him. Is not the sound of his master's feet right behind him?" And while he was still speaking with him, the messenger came to him and said, "This trouble is from he who is. Why should I wait for he who is any longer?" Now again, we're filling in the gaps of this siege from the information that we're getting here. Apparently there was a prophecy that this siege was coming, and that if the Israelis would just repent, God could save them from this famine. The king of Israel, which I believe is probably Jehoram at this time, doesn't seem to be on board with trusting God, and so he wants to blame Elisha for all of the turmoil that's going on right now. So, "Why should I wait for he who is any longer?" That would be the mindset of a disbeliever like Jehoram would be. Chapter 7. But Elisha said, "Hear the word of he who is. Thus says he who is, tomorrow about this time, a seah of fine flour." Now a seah is, let's see, it's about, let's try to remember here. Let me see if I can find it real quick. About seven liters or so of flour. So a couple of bags of flour. "It will be sold for a shekel." Now, a shekel varies in its buying power over time, but we can probably just shortcut it as being a couple of days' wages. So a good supply of flour is going to be sold for a fairly decent cost. And then two seahs of barley, which barley was not considered as fine a grain, as good a grain as wheat. So it will go, two seahs of barley will go for a shekel. So it'll be half the price for the same amount, which would be a very decent price, at the gate of Samaria. Now, we already know that they were paying an exorbitant amount of money for a donkey's head just because of the little bit of meat that was available on it. So there's no way in the world, under normal circumstances, could you get this amount of flour at Samaria for this decent of a price. It would have been out of anybody's capability of buying this at all. So that's why the captain, on whose hand the king leaned, said to the man of God, "If he who is himself should make windows in heaven, could this thing be?" So the guy that is the right-hand man to the king says, "You've got to be kidding. Even if God let it start raining right now, this couldn't happen." Which would, again, be literally true. It takes a good long time to come out of a drought, to come out of a famine. It doesn't just happen overnight. And so the guy says, "Impossible." But Elisha said back to him, "You shall see it with your own eyes, but you won't eat of it." Now that's a pretty specific prophecy as well, isn't it? We shift our attention now to outside the city of Samaria. Verse 3. "Now there were four men who were lepers at the entrance to the gate." Now lepers are those that have been marked by God, I believe, to show that there's some sort of thing that needs to be evaluated for change. I don't believe it's Hansen's disease. I know a lot of people teach it that way. But this condition, according to Jewish law, and therefore according to the traditions of the Middle East, was that if you had this mark, which was basically loss of color, of melanin, of the skin color, so that you looked white in patches, translucent white. If you had this, then you were expected to live outside the city, away from everybody else. And so sometimes people who were marked this way lived together. So there were these four men who were lepers, and they had been living at the entrance of the gate of Samaria. Just because there's a siege going on, didn't mean that they would be allowed to come into the city. And of course, the people outside the city, the Syrians who are carrying on this siege, they wouldn't be interested in lepers coming and living with them. So the lepers said to one another, "Why are we sitting here until we die? If we say, 'Let us enter the city,' the famine's in the city and we shall die there. So even if we could get into the city, there's no food there. If we sit here, we're going to just die. So now come, let's go over to the camp of the Syrians. If they spare our lives, we shall live. If they kill us, we shall but die." So we are between a rock and a hard place. Let's go see if the Syrians might have pity on us, you know, throw us some scraps. Even if they kill us on the spot, at least we'll be over. We'll be done. We'll be dead. So they arose at twilight to go to the camp of Syrians. So right around the time that the sun's getting ready to go down or has already gone down. "But when they came to the edge of the camp of the Syrians, behold, there was no one there. The siege camp is devoid of people. And the reason for that is this: for he who is had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and horses, the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, 'Behold, the king of Israel's hired against us the kings of the Hittites or the kings of the Egyptians to come against us.' So they fled away in the twilight and abandoned their tents, their horses, their donkeys, leaving the camp as it was, and they fled for their lives." So God had sent a miraculous panic on all of the Syrians living in this siege camp. They heard a noise. They assumed they were under attack. They didn't try to ride away. They didn't try to pack anything up. They just ran off and left everything behind, all the supplies. When these lepers came to the edge of the camp, they went into a tent. They ate and they drank. See, you know, there's food in there. It was just probably supper time. And so they go in and they just start gobbling up food. And then they carried off silver and gold and clothing, and they went and they hid them. So they see things of great value and they start grabbing those. You can appreciate this. You can understand this. They are just thinking in a knee-jerk fashion. They want to feed their face and they also want to enrich themselves. So that's what they did at the first tent. Then they came back. They entered into another tent. They didn't need to eat this time. They might have nibbled a little bit, but they did carry off more things and they went and they hid them. But eventually, you know, the novelty of this wears off and they start thinking through it. Then they said to one another, "Oh, we're not doing what's right. This day is a day of good news." Good news for the Israelis, right? Because the siege is over. "If we are silent and wait until the morning light, punishment will overtake us." So if we don't report this situation to the Israeli authorities, it's going to come out that we knew and didn't report it, and they'll get us. "Now, therefore, come, let us go and tell the king's household." So they came, they called to the gatekeepers of the city, and they told them, "We came to the city or to the camp of the Syrians. Behold, there's no one to be seen or heard there, nothing but the horses tied and the donkeys tied and the tents as they were." So they reported it. Then the gatekeepers called out, and it was told within the king's household. And then the king rose in the night, so he must have already gone to bed. He said to his servants, "I'll tell you what the Syrians have done to us. They know that we're hungry. Therefore, they've gone out of the camp to hide themselves in the open country, thinking when they come out of the city, we shall take them alive and get into the city." So the king, which I believe is Jehoram of northern Israel, he thinks it's all a ploy. He thinks it's a fake, that it's a trap set to try to get them to come out of the city and allow themselves to be captured. Now, one of his servants said, "Well, let some men take 5 of the remaining horses, seeing that those who are left here will fare like the whole multitude of Israel who have already perished. Let's send and see." So somebody comes up with the idea, "Well, let's just send a little party to check up on what the situation actually is. A group of men and very valuable horses, because during a siege, during a famine, you lose a lot of your animals. And so let's send this little search party out and see what the situation is." So they took 2 horsemen. So he doesn't go with 5. He goes with 2. And the king sent them after the army of the Syrians, saying, "You go and see. You know, you go and check the camp and then follow a trail from there to see where the Syrian army is." So they went after them as far as the Jordan. Now, the Jordan is like 20 miles away. And behold, all the way was littered with garments and equipment that the Syrians had thrown away in their haste. And then the messengers returned and told the king. So it was a blind panic that overtook the Syrians. That's clear. Because for a whole day's travel, the path of the retreating Syrian army is littered with stuff that they just keep throwing off, thinking that they've got to run faster. They've got to get away quicker. And so it is obvious this is not a ploy. This is not a trick. This is not an ambush. This is God's intervention. And so they come back and they pass that information on. And so now, what do they have? They have all of the supplies of the Syrian camp become the supplies of the kingdom of Samaria. The city of Samaria now has more than enough to live off of. So the people went out, they plundered the camp of the Syrians, and so a seah of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and two seahs of barley for a shekel, according to the word of he who is. So exactly the cost ratio that was predicted less than 24 hours earlier. Now the king, who had appointed the captain on whose hand he leaned to have charge of the gate. So the king, I believe, again, Jehoram, makes the guy that's taking care of the front gate the same guy that said, yeah, that's not going to happen about the cost. And what happened was that the people trampled him in the gate so that he died, as the man had God had said when the king came down to him. So Elisha had said, oh yeah, you'll see this price for supplies, but you won't get to eat any of it. And that's exactly right, because in the trampling mob trying to make the most of these new supplies, this guy got run over and never got a chance to eat a single bit of this. For when the man of God had said to the king, two seahs of barley will be sold for a shekel and a seah of fine flour for a shekel about this time in the gate of Samaria tomorrow, the captain had said to the man of God, if he himself should make windows in heaven, could such a thing be? And he said, you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it. And so it happened to him, for the people trampled him in the gate, and he died. At this point, we need to go to 2 Chronicles 21:19. This is a repeat of material we already saw, because like I said, some of these stories from 2 Kings, we can't figure out exactly where to fit them into the framework of the actual kings of north and south, northern Israel and southern Judah. So the last king of southern Judah that we were talking about was Jehoram, who was brother-in-law to Jehoram of northern Israel. And so this is what it said was the end of his 8 years on the throne. 2 Chronicles 21:19. In the course of time, at the end of 2 years, so he had a total of eight, so the last 2 years were really bad, his bowels came out because of the disease, he died in great agony, his people made no fire in his honor, like the fires made for his fathers. He was 32 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 8 years in Jerusalem, departed with no one's regret. They buried him in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. So I believe that all happened in 852 BC. Chapter 22. And the inhabitants of Jerusalem made Ahaziah, his youngest son, king in his place. So not the oldest boy, but the youngest boy. For the band of men that came with the Arabians to the camp had killed all the older sons. We actually read about that earlier, is that God had put a curse on Jehoram for his sinfulness, for his abandonment of the worship of the true and living God, his pushing of Baal worship and Asherah worship, just like in the northern kingdom. And so only his youngest son survived the invasion of Judah by these Bedouins out of the Arabian Peninsula, or out of the Sinai Peninsula. So Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, reigned. Ahaziah was 22 years old when he began to reign, and he only reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. That's going to be very important. His mother's name was Athaliah. Now, she is the princess of northern Israel that was married to Jehoram of southern Judah. And so she became queen for about 8 years. And so now she's going to be the queen mother. So his mother's name was Athaliah, the granddaughter of Omri. That would be Ahab's father. And so Athaliah was the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. So what's this new king of Judah like? Well, he also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor in doing wickedly. So he is greatly influenced by mom, who is all in on Baal worship and Asherah worship, because she is, in her heart still, devoted to northern Israel's religion, the religion of her late father Ahab and her still living mother Jezebel. And so this young man did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is, as the house of Ahab had done. For after the death of his father, they were his counselors to his undoing. So he is very much in the spirit of northern Israel. Now, this really is a blowing up of what I believe was the desire of King Jehoshaphat. I've mentioned this before a couple of times. Let me mention it again. Jehoshaphat is the one that allowed his son, Prince Jehoram, to get married to Athaliah, the princess of northern Israel. I believe that when he did it, his hope was that this would mend the break that took place between the two kingdoms, more than 75 years previous to that marriage. Because by marrying between these two families, the son born to Jehoram and Athaliah would have a right to both thrones, both northern Israel and southern Judah. And so I think Jehoshaphat was hoping that this would repair the damage, prepare the breach, or repair it and bring the two kingdoms back into one. But what it did instead was it allowed the attitudes and the sinful mindset of the northern kingdom to overtake the royal household of the southern kingdom. And so it actually backfired. It's another example of why believers should never marry outside their faith, ever, because it's just not worth the risk of losing the devotion to the one and true living God. Now, the next part is this, verse 5. He even followed their counsel and went with Jehoram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, to make war against Hazael, king of Syria, at Ramoth-Gilead. Now, Hazael, as far as I can tell, is not yet the king at this time in our chronology, I don't believe. But he is the commander who is running the army for the king of Syria. And sometimes when a commander who becomes king is talked about when he's still commander. They kind of refer to him as the king. It's similar to us using the term president when we talk about somebody and the things that they were doing well before they became president. It's just an honorific used ahead of time because we know how this is all going to turn out. So what happens is Ramoth-Gilead is in eastern northern Israel. It's the very place that was being fought over by King Ahab when he ended up dead. It has become a point of contention on a border between Syria to the north and Israel to the south. And so it's still a problem. It's still a disputed territory. And so Jehoram of northern Israel says, "Hey, nephew," because Ahaziah is his nephew, "why don't you come with me and help me take back Ramoth-Gilead from those nasty Syrians?" And so he does. And during the process of fighting, we are told this: the Syrians wounded Joram. That's the king of northern Israel. And he returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds that he'd received at Ramah when he fought against Hazael, king of Syria. So the northern king gets himself wounded. So he retreats back to Jezreel to recuperate. And we'll leave it at this. Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, went down to see Joram, the son of Ahab, in Jezreel because he was wounded. So the nephew goes to check up on his uncle.